Chapter 12. Impervious and impregnable were words spoken by tyrants since the first earthworks of antiquity had been thrown up around their great halls. History told grim tales of how such words were no more than empty boasts, that time and firepower could bring down any wall. No fastness was ever impregnable, no wall impervious, and there was no artifice of man that could not be torn down. Or so Forex had always thought. As Kroger laid siege to the Emperor's palace, he watched with grim amusement as Perturabo fended off his first attacks. For all his initial bluster that he was no warsmith, Kroger was holding his own, making cautious moves to test his enemy and bold offensives in an attempt to catch him off balance. Perturabo was falling for none of it, and each time it appeared Kroger might have made some significant gain, a later gambit of the Primarch's would reveal it for the trap it was. Overextended thrusts were decapitated, and the proxy warriors, caught in the pockets, quickly surrounded and destroyed. The siege was played out at speed, days passing in minutes, as Kroger's armies crashed against the walls of the palace like bloody breakers. The earthworks at Haldwani, long regarded as fundamentally flawed by the Iron Warriors, took every punishment Kroger could hurl at them, and the Legion Warriors manning them even mounted a number of devastating sorties through their fire-blackened gates. Divisions of men and swaggering mobs of Titans were removed almost as soon as they took to the field of battle. Orbital plates saturated the battlefield with earth-shaking bombardments, and emplaced guns swept the Gangetic plain with hellish pyro-storms in the wake of repeated strafing runs and incendiary barrages. Kroger was controlling a continent's worth of armies single-handedly, and the strain of such a complex command was starting to show. He began to make mistakes. Like a gifted amateur playing a host of regicide grandmasters at once, he could not hope to see every angle and every riposte to his attacks. Every warsmith in the hall gathered round, their own battle simulations now meaningless in the face of this titanic conflict. The petitioner's city fell to Kroger's armies, flattened to a rocky desert as it became a battleground of titanic war engines. Its dispossessed inhabitants fought alongside the legions of the Emperor, rising up in a great ragtag host to defend their demolished homes and ruined lives. The navigator's quarter vanished in a seething cauldron of flame, a sudden drop assault contained within its boundaries, and incinerated under a relentless barrage of Imperial shells and counter-attacking battle robots. It had been a baited trap, and now the foremost shock troops of Kroger's army had been slaughtered for nothing. Where the gathered warsmiths had shouted encouragement and heckled in previous iterations of this battle, they now watched in silence, awed at the performance of their Primarch as he conducted the music of battle like a virtuoso. Where Kroger struggled to keep up with his available forces, the avenues of attack opening or denied him, Perturabo had no such trouble. His forces came smoothly to him, his every opportunity seized, his every setback transformed from a potential disaster to a superlative counter-strike. It was an unequal struggle, but Kroger wasn't about to give in. Brahmaputra, the great avenue into the heart of the palace, was held by a golden army of custodians, and Kroger contented himself by pinning them in place, while launching attacks across the canyons of the Karnali and the bleak precincts of the City of Sight. Far from being an easy route through a benighted region of the palace, the Psyker's enclave was held by the Black Sentinels, reinforced by mysterious regiments that went unlabeled on the hololithic projectors. Falk leaned over and whispered, "He's not doing too well, is he?"
"Better than I thought he would."
"True," admitted Falk. "You think he could use some help?"
"Almost certainly," said Forex, nodding towards the Dawalagiri prospect. "But let's see how he takes on the custodian's assault."
"What custodian's assault? The only one deployed are the ones at Brahmaputra, and they're not going anywhere."
"Wait and see."
An unstoppable charge of hundreds of battle titans strode up the statue-lined prospects of the Dawalagiri.
To group so many of his mightiest war machines in one assault was risky. But looking at the disposition of forces, Forex couldn't blame Kroger for taking the potentially battle-ending gambit. But Kroger hadn't seen what Forex had. The custodes, pinned in place at Brahmaputra, were not custodes at all, merely a decoy to mask the presence of the Emperor's Praetorians elsewhere. In a sweeping pincer, two golden sickle-bladed sorties swept out from the sunken bartizan towers of the outer precincts of the Dawalagiri. The artillery that had pounded the great avenue to splintered ruin fell to the vengeful Imperials, and the guns turned on the Titans, crashing up the Dawalagiri like mindless savages sacking the capital of a dying empire. No sooner had the guns staggered the battle engines than Pertirabo launched his iron fist. Lion's Gate burst open, and a reserve of Titans emerged to do battle, riding out like knights of old with their lances lowered. The custodians fell on the scrums of infantry supporting the Titans, and within moments the Dawalagiri was a corpse-choked wasteland of dead attackers. And with the fall of the last war engine, the battle was over, and the palace saved. Kroger had nothing left to carry the day, and he threw his hands up in defeat, angry and elated in the same moment. He looked like he'd fought the Iron Circle in a sparring session. Once again, time unwound, and the scene before them reverted to its original setting, but this time there was remarkably little of the palace to be rebuilt. The previous engagement had seen it reduced to rubble, a Gothic ruin of shattered marble, burning glass and molten gold. Pertirabo's defence had preserved all but the most functional of walls.
"You won, my lord," said Kroger.
"Of course I won," said Pertirabo. "Dawn is a fool and wastes time and effort with the idea that everything he has done to the palace can be undone. He builds a fortress with one hand tied behind his back, thinking that he can put everything back the way it was. Once a thing is broken, it will always be broken. But my brother cannot accept that."
"It was an honour to face you, my lord," said Kroger.
Pertirabo looked at him strangely, and Forex saw what was coming a heartbeat before the Primarch waved him and Falk forwards. The Primarch shook his head.
"You think we're done here?"
"My lord?"
"Now it is my turn to attack," said Pertirabo.
It was over in moments. Pertirabo's armies blew their way through the massive earthwork defences at Haldwani and Zigazi. The sky at the top of the world was on fire, despite the bombardments of the orbital plates and the constant sorties of stormbirds and the hawkwings. The Lord of Iron's legions advanced up through the Brahmaputra along the delta of the Karnali. Continental firestorms raged across the Gangetic Plain once again. As they entered the rampart outworks of the palace, his streaming, screaming multitudes and the striding war machines were greeted by monsoons of firepower. Every emplacement along the Dawalagiri prospect committed its weapons. Lasfire reached out in neon slashes, annihilating everything it touched. Shells fell like sleet. Titans exploded, caught fire, collapsed on their faces, and crushed the warriors swarming around their heels. Still they came. Lancing beams struck the armour-reinforced walls like lightning. The walls fell. They collapsed like slumping glaciers. Gold-cased bodies spilled out, tumbling down in the deluge. The palace began to burn. Primus Gate fell. Lion's Gate subjected to attack from the north. Annapurna Gate. At the ultimate gate, Pertirabo's divisions finally sliced into the palace, slaughtering everyone they found inside. Around every broken gate, the corpses of Titans piled up in vast, jumbled heaps where they had fallen over each other in their desire to breach the walls. The victorious host clambered across their carcasses, pouring into the palace to fall upon its master and tear him from his golden throne in readiness for the galaxy's new ruler. The combined tactical ability of three of the greatest iron warriors had singularly failed to keep Pertirabo out. A salutary reminder that the master of defence was also the master of attack. Under his command, the palace would be an ironclad fortress, but as his target, it was a fragile thing just waiting to be broken open. Before the attacking Red Division swarmed over the inner precincts of the palace, Perturabo ended the simulation. The holographic elements of the battle faded, leaving only the broad sweep of the sculpted table in its wake. Perturabo leaned over the ruins of the ultimate gate and shook his head with a wry grin.
"I am better than you, brother," he said, as much to himself as to those around him. "I will always be better than you. I know that's what you're really afraid of."
The Stonewrought's title was well deserved, for while it was said that he was fashioned from the very substance of worlds, Sultan Vulbron knew that it was literally true for all of them, but refrained from pointing out what should have been obvious. They were all made from the leavings of stars, ejected matter compressed and reshaped by billions of years of stellar engineering and biochemical and electrical reactions. Whether his understanding of this gave him insight into the heart of the stone was a mystery he did not examine too closely. That the stone spoke to him and unveiled its secrets and strengths was enough for him. To know its structure and composition came as naturally to him as breathing, and amongst a legion like the Iron Warriors, that made him special. Though not, apparently, special enough to avoid this onerous duty. Accompanied by a brutish warrior named Cadarus Grendel from the Grand Battalion of Warsmith Barossus, Vulbron made his way through the fetish-hung corridors of the Pride of the Emperor. They followed a limping warrior named Lord Commander Eidolon, who wore a razor-hooked cloak over his garishly coloured armour and bore a monstrously heavy hammer, not unlike that of the Lord of Iron. Eidolon had greeted them cordially on the embarkation deck, accompanied by an honour guard of warriors whose armour was a riot of clashing colours and horned spikes. The gorgets of their armour extended beyond their shoulders, fitted with all manner of vox pickups and augmeter enhancers. Their helms bulged with aural implants, and instead of bolters they carried bizarre weaponry that pulsed like generators on the verge of an overload. Eidolon had named them Cacophonae, but had declined to explain their nature. Vulbron tried to conceal his shock at the sight of the Emperor's children's flagship, but he was sure that Eidolon had seen his reaction and grinned. The Lord Commander's manner put Vulbron on edge. His skin was ashen and lifeless, his eyes sunken in their sockets like those of a cadaver. The Pride of the Emperor was a place of light and noise, of spectacle and grotesqueries. At every turn, Vulbron's eyes beheld some new and terrible sight. His senses reeled at the sensory overload, but the journey to La Fenice was just the beginning. Rumours had spread amongst the War Master's allies of the great debauch that had taken place here, an opera of such staggering excess that it had driven the Emperor's children to madness. No one had really believed it, but as the warped doors of the Grand Theatre swung open before him, Vulbron suddenly believed every wild rumour and knew them to have entirely failed to capture the horror of what had truly happened. "Throne," he hissed, before remembering the inappropriateness of that oath. No one appeared to notice. Cadarus Grendel let out a breath of astonishment.
"Welcome to La Fenice," said Eidolon.
Vulbron had seen pictures of Fulgrim's grand theatrical ballroom, some reportedly taken by the renowned Euphrates Keeler, but this place bore only a fleeting resemblance to that once magnificent playhouse. Vulbron squinted through the dazzling beams of intense light strobing down from the arched roof, barely able to make out shadowy forms moving through the clouds of musky incense that boiled from hanging censers like an alchemical experiment gone wrong. The stench was sickly sweet, hot and fragrant, but with a lingering hint of something rotten beneath. It caught at the back of Vulbron's throat, and he wanted to spit to rid his mouth of the taste, feeling some lingering after-effect worming its way into his system. Garlands of faces and stretched canvases of human skin hung from the royal boxes above, and bouquets of bones sprouted from dripping iron sconces. Unseen drums boomed in a discordant thunder like an arrhythmic heartbeat that wove in and out of a roaring, squealing morass of sounds from swaying voxcasters. The Thaliacron had majesty and grandeur, but Laphanice had none of that.
"What have you done to this place?" asked Vulbron.
"Raised it to the level of wonder,"
said Eidolon, his voice little more than a rasping growl, as though his throat and vocal cords were no longer working in sync. Mindful of his status as a guest, Vulbron said,
"It is like nothing I have ever seen."
"Few have," agreed Eidolon. "It must be a welcome change from the tedious formality of the Dodecatheon. Here we celebrate what we have become rather than dwelling on the past or things that might have been but never will be."
"The Dodecatheon is a gathering of warriors," said Vulbron, masking his irritation at Eidolon's casual insult. "We gather to better ourselves."
"As do we," said Eidolon, leading him deeper into Laphanice.
Their path wound through a cavalcade of nightmares made real, a corruption of everything for which the legions had once stood. Vulbron saw flesh opened up and the glistening insides brought forth for sport, for interest, and for pleasure. Mortals and legion warriors made play with their bodies, cutting them with symbols and designs that were beyond comprehension or belief. Great casks of wine were siphoned with intestinal pipes, like giant organs being drained of their vital fluids. Heaped piles of reclining bodies drew smoke from drooling hookers, their eyes glassy and limbs slack. Grendel paused to snatch a fleshy tube from a supine legionary with blood-frothed saliva drooling from the corner of his mouth. He sucked hard and grimaced at the taste of whatever was coming through the tube. He spat a mouthful of viscous ooze that looked like the scrapings from a cancerous lung.
"It's not Olympian vintage, but it's got a kick to it," said Grendel.
"Touch nothing," ordered Vulbron, but Grendel ignored him and took another swig.
Creatures that might once have been human stalked the theatre like numinous observers, being so far removed from their original physical template that they were an entirely new species. Bodies of patchwork torsos from a dozen different individuals moved with reptilian locomotion on limbs that were a mix of arms and legs taken apart, broken and remade in dozens of unique and terrible ways, like the aborted failures of some diseased creation myth. Lunatic eyes stared at him, and he recoiled from the repugnant mix of joy and terror, ecstasy and insanity in the faces grafted to the bellies and spines of the unnatural creatures.
"From iron cometh strength," said Vulbron, girding himself against the abomination, but the words sounded hollow, as though drained of their power in this place of dark raptures.
"The unbreakable litany," laughed Eidolon. "In time you will learn nothing is unbreakable."
"What are they?" said Vulbron, as the nearest gestalt creature moved away, followed by capering, hunched figures chained to it like offspring wailing to be suckled.
"Fabius calls them his territor,"
spat Eidolon, his hand unconsciously going to his neck. "Territor?" Eidolon waved a dismissive hand at the departing monstrosity, relishing Vulbron's discomfort.
"It's what he calls the deformed monsters he makes aboard the Andronicus, with gene seed torn from the dead. He treats them like children."
"Some children," said Grendel, "wouldn't want to meet the mother."
Vulbron asked nothing more of the hideous territor, hearing the disgust and hatred in Eidolon's voice. Whatever this twisted apothecary Fabius was to Eidolon, clearly there was no love lost between them. The smoke parted for a moment, like a curtain being drawn in readiness for a performance. A baying crowd of legionaries and mortals watched a warrior with a tattooed cheek leaping and spinning across the stage with a pair of silver-bladed swords. His skill was breathtaking, his movements like a dancer.
"Who's the swordsman?" asked Grendel, wiping black residue from his chin with the back of his hand and a grimace of distaste.
"Bastanaya Branks," said Eidolon, "a captain of what was once the 85th Company."
"He is supremely skilled," said Vulbron, still observing the correct protocol in the face of what he now understood was its utter inconsequence. Eidolon's shoulders lurched awkwardly, and Vulbron realized it was a shrug.
"He fancies himself a great bladesman, but he is no more than competent."
"He's not bad," said Grendel, sizing a Branks up as though they might one day be enemies.
"We have better," admitted Eidolon with some reluctance. "Cross us, and you'll find out how much better."
Part boast, part threat, Eidolon's attempt at superiority was clumsy. Vulbron ignored the jibe. In a place like this, what did petty rivalries matter? Vulbron swallowed back a strange nausea, gritting his teeth and blinking away the irritation of the drifting fog of seductive musks.
"I'm finding it hard to believe," said Grendel,
watching as a host of black-clad warriors invaded the stage with screaming blades, but were taken apart in a blistering series of dazzling thrusts, ripostes, and decapitating cuts.
"There is one of the Legion known as Lucius who makes a Branks look like a crippled child," said Eidolon, looking as if he was choking on the words.
"I've heard of him," said Grendel. "He's supposed to be good."
Grendel vanished into the perfumed smoke to witness more of the swordsman's display, leaving Vulbron with Eidolon. Berossus's man had come armed, so perhaps he fancied his chances against de Branks. Vulbron hoped not, but he was already growing less and less concerned with what happened to Cadarus Grendel. Or to himself, truth be told. Eidolon led him to a booth that felt like an island of normality in this kaleidoscope of marvels and wondrous new sensation. Vulbron had never known such an array of sensory bombardment, and though he had resisted the gamut of the unknown and the fearsome at first, he was now beginning to enjoy what he was experiencing. The booth was cushioned with soft fabrics, velveteen, silk, variegated damask, and rough textures like shark skin or squid hide. The sensation of reclining on them was unusual, but not unpleasant, and Vulbron found that he was, despite his earlier reticence, finding much to his liking in La Fenice. He wondered what the Emperor's children's representative to the Iron Blood would make of their staid legion practices. Naked slaves, surgically modified with extra limbs like ancient blue-skinned goddesses, slipped into the booth. They carried elaborate hookers with snaking pipes sheathed in serpentine scales and filled with bubbling smoke that coiled into deliberate cursive shapes.
"What is that?" asked Vulbron as a hooker was set before him.
"A concoction of the Phoenician," said Eidolon. "A key to the doors of perception and a means of finding the answers to all the questions you never even knew you were asking."
"Sounds potent," said Vulbron, already anticipating his first taste.
"It is," agreed Eidolon, unhooking the pipe and holding it out to Vulbron. "Especially the first time you try it, especially in the Eye of Terror."
"Eye of Terror?"
Eidolon looked confused, as though he had no idea where that name had come from.
"This warp storm," said Eidolon hesitantly. "That's what it's called."
Vulbron nodded. He knew that. How he knew it, he couldn't recall, but it felt as though he had always known it. He had no memory of being told the name, but there was no doubting its appropriateness. He shook his head and took the pipe, its surface texture wet and organic.
"Skin?" he asked.
"Leia,"
nodded Eidolon, pulling in a great lungful of shimmering smoke. His corpse eyes lost their emptiness for a moment, and his jaw stretched wider than any mouth should ever stretch. Tendrils of smoke gusted from his enlarged throat. Volbron knew he should be horrified at the sight, but the sheer incongruity of it all was strangely fascinating. He took a breath from the hooker, and a liquid grin spread across his face as the world around him appeared to sharpen, as though each edge and line were etched with greater force on the fabric of reality. He saw echoes in movement, sound as ripples in the air, and darting shapes that danced on the edges of his vision. Everything suddenly seemed to be more real, as though what he had thought was reality was now revealed to be little more than a veneer over the true face of the world. More of the adapted slaves appeared, each more outrageously mutilated than the last, and where they had shocked him before, he found himself reveling in each new disfigurement. They came bearing silver ewers, and a slave whose gender was impossible to fix held out a goblet that threw dazzling refractions of light in all directions from the complex lattice of its cut crystal. Volbron tried to follow the myriad beams of light, reaching up to touch them, but gave up as another slave, one with what looked like two halves of separate faces alloyed together, poured a clear, viscous fluid into the goblet he wasn't even aware he'd taken. A heady aroma of salt swam in his senses, and he raised the goblet cautiously to his face.
"Ah, this you will like," promised Eidolon. "What is it?" "We call it Lacrimosa," said Eidolon, "an exquisite wine bled from the tears of slaves."
Volbron took a tentative sip. His eyes widened. The taste was, as Eidolon had promised, exquisite. The suffering of a thousand mortals distilled into a single mouthful. The flavour was pain and pleasure combined, a heady symphony of aromas from the erotic to the repugnant. It was heights and depths of emotion in liquid form. He tilted his face back to drain his goblet, and his eyes widened as he saw the portrait hanging high above their booth. He gasped as he recognised the image of Fulgrim, clad as Volbron remembered him, what seemed like a lifetime ago. The plates of his armour were brilliantly illuminated, each curve and sweep of a golden wing or the palatine aquila upon his heroic form brilliantly rendered, as though Fulgrim himself looked down upon him. As heroic as any portrait hung in the palaces of the Delconian tyrant, this was Fulgrim as he had imagined himself to be. Volbron met the eyes of the portrait, and the lacrimosa curdled in his mouth. A jolt of sublime pleasure punched into his system, and he felt himself being pulled deeper into a morass of pure sensation. He had come to this place revolted, and a diminishing portion of his consciousness still cried out at the terrible things he was seeing, but the part of him that felt disgust was being compressed within him like the core of a dying star.
"I should not be here,"
he said, feeling as though the words were coming from someone else's throat.
"This is not the way of the Iron Warriors."
"It could be," suggested Eidolon.
"The Lord of Iron would never agree to it," he said, fighting to keep his thoughts coherent. He would have no choice were the pleasures of the lords of profligacy to be brought to the Dodecotheon in secret, spread through the Fourth Legion thanks to its mason's lodge. Perturabo would have no choice but to accept the flesh profundities of the Dark Prince.
Dark Prince? Asked Vulbron, already feeling the question squirming away from him.
Isn't there a delicious frisson to be had in violating the mores of what most would call civilized, in revelling in that which others call debauched? Said Eidolon, blowing a mouthful of potent hookah smoke in his face. We have all broken our most treasured oath, so what does one more violation matter? Or 10 more?
Vulbron nodded, the sense of what Eidolon was saying now obvious to him.
"You're right," he said, the words coming from his mouth despite the screaming warning in his skull. "I understand now."
"Drink," said Eidolon, refilling his goblet. "Seal your pact with the Dark Prince."
Vulbron smiled and raised the goblet to his lips.
"Yes, I think I will."
Before he could drink, a figure loomed from the smoke before him and knocked the goblet from his hand with a backhanded slap. Enraged, he sprang to his feet, finding himself face to face with Cadarus Grendel.
"I'm within, Stonerot," said Grendel,
and the words were a cold knife in his heart.
"I think it's time we departed, don't you?"
"I will kill you for that," snapped Vulbron.
"No," said Grendel, casting a poisonous glance at Eidolon. "You'll thank me."
Grendel's sledgehammer fist slammed into his face, and all the light and pleasure went out of the world. Freighter Thermatica's earlier failure to make the thermic displacement beamer functional had not discouraged him from a second attempt. In fact, it had made him more determined than ever to rectify what had gone wrong before. He paced before the control mechanisms, watching the needles monitoring the power levels being fed into the magnetic gimbals as they sat at the farthest extreme of measurement.
"That's better," he said, tapping an iron finger on one dial that fluctuated more than most.
Down the laboratorium, two new spheres, reconstituted from the amalgamated remains of the first pair, spun in their concentric rings. The magnetic fields surrounding them were orders of magnitude more powerful than the ones he had employed when Wayland had come to observe, hence the greater distance between them and his control station. 30 chattering, calculus loci sat on 3 long benches arranged behind him, like worshippers at a heathen fane. Each blank-faced, shaven-headed Autept was linked in parallel to his neighbour by a sheaf of coloured ribbon cables, and their already phenomenal computational power was enhanced still further by the shared mind space he had created in his most powerful data engine. Working as one linked brain, their eyes closed to keep all non-essential sensory inputs to a minimum. They crunched the vast array of arithmetical data and hexamathic geometries he needed to keep control of the building power. Thematica was certain he had the variables worked out of the experiment. It was all a matter of managing colossal power inputs and balancing them against the titanic energy requirements. His theory was sound, but Thematica knew that theory had a perverse way of not matching up to practice. A dozen servitors, stripped of their mechanized parts, as far as was practical, maintained the machinery of the experiment in close proximity to the two rapidly rotating spheres. Thematica didn't dare approach too close to the machine. He was far too augmented to survive such conflicting magnetic fields. The energy would literally tear him limb from limb. He checked the cascades of data on the numerous panels, giving each one a cursory inspection, but enough to satisfy himself that everything was as it should be. This was a highly dangerous experiment, but Thematica's sense of such things had diminished in the wake of every mechanical augmentation he had undergone.
Ferus Manus himself had often spoken with the Iron Fraternity of that reduced humanity, of its dangers and its potential to erode their human compassion, but any thoughts of acting upon that warning had been swept aside in the wake of his death. The thought of his Primarch's murder left Thaumaticus strangely cold, and in his darker moments he had begun to question the wisdom of his legion's chosen path to enhanced augmentation. He had seen a direct correlation between the lack of human empathy in a warrior and the level of bionic enhancements he had undergone. It could be a fascinating avenue of research, but now was not the time for such indulgences. In times of war, the Iron Fraternity were more concerned with the construction of weapons than with matters of philosophy. Such things were the purview of the Librarius, or at least they would have been had the Iron Hands ever possessed such an institution. He shook off such tangential thoughts and returned to the matter in hand. The power levels were all approaching the regions the calculus logi had extrapolated that he would require, and the magnetic field strength was stable. As he had said to Wayland, he required bigger generators, and had linked his experimental machinery to the plasma drives, diverting their power to his laboratorium. On some level he knew he should have sought permission from Cadmus Tyro for that, but the irascible captain would only have refused. Where was the sense in asking for what would almost certainly be denied?
"Yes," he said to himself, "yes, this will work, and even if it doesn't, it's always easier to ask for forgiveness than permission."
Thaumatica pushed the activation button on his console, coupling the engine outputs to the machinery empowering his device. The readouts all began to climb, and Thaumatica recorded them all through the data capture optics in his bionic eye. Lightning arced between the two spheres, a dancing web of eye-watering brightness. Three of the servitors were immolated by backwashing electrical discharge before self-preservation protocols made the others back away. The power contained there could vaporize the entire ship, and Thaumatica began to channel that power into the experimental machinery that would begin the quantum swapping between the two spheres. All he had to do was throw the two switches that would complete the circuit. His hands hovered over the switches as a moment of doubt nested in the back of his mind.
"What if this goes wrong?" he said, turning to the gibbering calculus logi Otepts.
They had no answer for him, only waste numbers and remainders. The flow of hexamathical calculus was reassuring in its simplicity, and Thaumatica let out a relieved breath. He nodded, and waved a hand as if silencing their admonition.
"Of course, yes, you're right," he said. "What purpose is served by timidity?"
He closed the switches, and a thunderous bang echoed as the power levels spiked vertiginously. Relays blew out in an instant, and lightning strikes whipped out in streaks of blazing energy and seismic detonation.
"You bloody fool, Thaumatica," he shouted, as the calculus logi shrieked with one voice, and their shared mindspace blew out in a surge of feedback. All 30 slumped over, blood streaming from their fried brain cavities and smoke boiling from their skulls. It was impossible to know how far overloaded the system was. Every needle and readout had melted. Thaumatica looked towards the two spheres. Blinding light flowed between them, and the servitors were gone, immolated by the expanding ball of electromagnetic fire. How this version of his experiment could have gone wrong was a question for another day, and Thaumatica slammed his palm down on the emergency shutdown. The power to the devices surrounding the spheres was cut off in an instant, and a billow of electrically charged air was all that remained of the potentially catastrophic power surge. Thaumatica let out a sigh of relief and frustration, scanning the ruined console before him to see what, if anything, could be salvaged from this latest setback. Almost nothing remained of his data recorders, but the one surviving gauge told him exactly where the vast quantities of power vented from the experiment had gone and what it would look like to any other ship in the vicinity.
"Ah, electromagnetic venting," he said. "That's not good. That's not good at all."